We were in 1 Corinthians 11 last week, and I want to actually pick up where we left off. This is part of my series on worship. And actually, we don't have a whole lot in the New Testament that describes a typical Christian worship time in the early church during the apostolic times, but probably the most descriptive passage that gives us the most information would be 1 Corinthians, actually the book of 1 Corinthians, but particularly chapters 10 through 14. And last week we talked a little bit about, well, in some depth, we talked about women and head coverings and all that. And we're going to move on from that. If you remember, at the beginning of chapter 11, Paul says, "Imitate me just as I also imitate Christ." And then he says, "I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you." So he started out the chapter by praising them for the fact that they were following through with the traditions that he had delivered to them. And then he goes on in the next verses to explain the theological reasons behind those traditions, which we covered last week. But now, after all that, we get down to verse 17. He changes his tone. The book of 1 Corinthians is very interesting because there are times when the Apostle Paul commends the church in Corinth for what they were doing right, and there are other times that he took them out to the woodshed and gave them a good thrashing. And here he's going to take them out and give them a good thrashing. So he commends them for what they did right, and now he says, verse 17, "Now, in giving these instructions," that is what follows, "I do not praise you." He just said he praised them for what preceded it. "But for this, I don't have anything good to say about you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. For there must also be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you." What is that saying? There were some factions. He talked previously in Corinthians about different factions, some who claimed that they were of Paul, some said they were of Apollos, and so forth. But here he's saying that there must also be factions, and then there's a reason. There's actually, he draws a, there's a good result that can come out of this. Jordan?
It's going to reveal who's genuine and like it's feasible.
Right.
Right,
the cream comes to the top, I guess you might say, right? Those who are truly following Christ will be made manifest in contrast to these others. "Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper." Now, this is a very misleading statement, and I'm sorry to, I hate it when I have to tell you that your English translation isn't very good when it comes to the Greek. This is one phrase that is misleading, and because of that, it's difficult to comprehend what Paul's saying. The word, you see where it says Lord, the Lord's Supper, that phrase there? The word Lord's is not a good translation of the Greek text. The word Lord in Greek is kurios. It's a noun. That's not what's here. And if you were going to make it a possessive, like the Lord's, that's a possessive in English, right? You would put it in the genitive case in Greek. It's not a noun, and it's not in the genitive case, which means I don't know why the translators translate it that way, except they didn't know what the passage meant, and they were just trying to figure it out. But the word that's used there is kuriakos, and kuriakos is an adjective, not a noun. And as an adjective, it's modifying the word supper. So it's describing a quality of the supper, it's not a possessive saying it's the Lord's supper. All right? I know it's what it says in your English translation, but that's not what it says in the Greek text. And literally, this Greek adjective means Lord-like, or having a quality, or some kind of, let me put it this way. The word Lord, what does that mean to you? It doesn't necessarily mean Christ. It was a common word in Greek. Kurios was a common word in Greek, and it simply referred to your superior. Your boss could be your Lord. If you were a husband and wife, and the wife was submitting to her husband, Sarah called Abraham Lord. Did you know that? Because she was acknowledging him as her superior, or somebody that's superior to you. And that's all the word means. It's normally translated master or Lord, but it doesn't necessarily refer to God, necessarily. Okay, it can, because he is our superior. But kuriakos is an adjective which would mean something like having a quality of a Lord or somebody that's superior. And so it's modifying the word supper. So essentially what it's saying is, in verse 20, therefore when you come together in one place, it is not to eat a supper fit for a Lord, or a supper that has a quality of, with some great person might have. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Like, you might just simply say an elaborate supper. Or some kind of a, big, elaborate meal that is fit for somebody who is a ruler of some kind.
A banquet,
yeah. That's what the word actually means. And I did a lot of research on that word to make sure of that fact. And that's exactly what it means, all right? So, what is Paul saying then? When you come together into one place, it is not to eat a big, elaborate banquet. He's talking about coming together to worship. The point of us coming together to worship is not to eat some big, expensive spread. That's what he's saying. Verse 21. And now he goes on to describe what they were doing while they were making a big, elaborate meal out of this instead of simply coming together for worship. He says, for in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry, another is drunk. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? Shame those who have nothing. So what were they doing? Some of the people in Corinth were very wealthy. Some of the people in Corinth were not so wealthy. They were pretty poor. And so you had some wealthy people coming to church, and they're bringing a big elaborate banquet for themselves and for their family and eating there. And then there's some poor people who can't afford, they might have pork and beans or something. They didn't have much. And they're shaming, by making a big elaborate banquet for themselves and their family, they're shaming other people who don't have much. Instead of perhaps sharing with them. Oh, there's a thought. No, they weren't doing that. They were making a show out of a big banquet that they brought to the church for their own families and so forth. Verse 23, for I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. Now, what is he saying? Why does he bring that up here? He condemns them for their manner in which they were coming to the assembly to worship God, and in the process of doing that, they were bringing their big banquet And the rich people had a big, elaborate banquet there, while the poor people had hardly anything. And Paul condemns them for that, and then he immediately goes into talking about what he told them about keeping what? The communion, right? Which Jesus commanded us to keep. Now, let me ask you this. Is it sinful for you to bring a sandwich to church? Is it sinful for us to have snacks on the back table? What was Paul condemning eating at church?
No.
We're going to eat at church after we're through with the service. What was he condemning? Jordan?
Kind of like almost like showing off like your world's possessions in a sense. Like basically it's a sign also of your wealth.
Yep. Not only that, he even goes on to talk about how some there were indulging themselves and getting drunk even.
Not sharing.
What's that?
Not sharing.
Let me ask you a question. He brings them back to the purpose for why they're there, which was Jesus commanded us to do this right here, right? That's what he talks about. This is why we're here. We're not here to have a big elaborate banquet and show everybody up or show off our wealth by the kind of food that we bring and the kind of expensive wine we might bring or whatever it is, right? We're here for this, right, Jordan?
Weren't they really big about having large feasts?
Yes. In fact, that's exactly where I was going.
Oh, okay, sorry.
No, don't have to be sorry here. You're anticipating. I was going to ask you, why would they do that in the church? Why would these Corinthians even go there? What even gave them that idea to do that? And you're on the right track. Jordan, go ahead.
I know they worship God like Bacchus, who's all about the wine, getting drunk, you know. They had large feasts, they grew up and eat again.
Where did they have those large feasts?
I don't remember.
At the pagan temples. See, these Corinthians are Gentiles. And as Gentiles, Corinth is just down the road from Athens, which was the center of Greek philosophy and Greek paganism. Anybody ever been to Athens and seen all the pagan temples that still exist even today? Right? Yet nobody's ever been to Athens. I haven't either, but I've seen pictures. You can see the ruins of all these pagan temples. And one of the things that the pagans did and that these Gentiles used to do before they became Christians and followers of Christ is they went to the pagan temples. And part of pagan worship was big, elaborate, drunken festivals where not only did they get drunk, they had sex with temple prostitutes. That was part of their worship, by the way, of the pagan gods, depending on which pagan god or goddess it happened to be. They had different rituals that were so vile and corrupt. They had not only temple prostitutes, they had male prostitutes for the women, and they had male prostitutes for men. You get my drift of what kind of stuff went on at the pagan temples. And a lot of it was eating and drinking, and a lot of drunkenness took place there. And the Apostle Paul, in fact, just flip back, keep your finger there, but flip back to chapter 10. The Apostle Paul, also in chapter 10, talks about the Lord's table, the communion that we did there. And let's look at verse 15. I speak as to wise men, judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body, for we all partake of that one bread. Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar? What am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything? Rather, the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, this is what they do at the pagan temples. They sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? Wow. You think that provokes God to jealousy? What was he talking about here? He was talking about the question of whether or not it was okay for a Christian, because he understands that a pagan idol is nothing. There is no God that that idol represents. Therefore, if he is invited by his neighbor to go to the pagan temple and have a big festival, what's the harm at the pagan temple? What's the harm? That's the question Paul was dealing with here. And he's saying, look, you come into God's house and you partake of these holy things that represent his blood and his flesh. And then you're going to leave and go to a pagan temple and partake in a pagan feast. And then he reminds them of what the Old Testament said, which was that the pagans are worshiping not just empty idols, but they're worshiping demons. Because behind every pagan idol, every pagan religion was a demonic force. And so that idol represented a demon. And so what he's saying is, if you do that, here's what you're doing. You're worshiping at God's house, at God's table, and then you're going and worshiping at a demon's house and at his table. And I don't want you to have fellowship with demons. Yes?
Translating to today's time, is that kind of like going to church and then going to, say, a club? Or we don't have a pagan temple, but...
We do have pagan temples. They just don't call them that. Sure. If you go into places where, you know, people are indulging in open sin and rebellion against God and all that, yeah, it's the same idea. Sure. So he's saying, look, pick who you're going to follow. Follow God or follow the demons, but don't do both. Why does he say that? What does he say? He talks about provoking God to jealousy. Isn't that right?
Well, yes. You can't serve two gods.
You can't. That's right. You can't serve two gods. You have to choose one or the other. But God is a jealous God. What does that mean? God says he's a jealous God. Now, normally, we think of jealousy as being a bad thing. Right? But there is a good kind of jealousy, and there's a bad kind of jealousy. We know what the bad kind of jealousy is. I want what you got. That's envy. What's the good jealousy?
I just wanted to add something. There's an actual church, which will remain unnamed, in Tampa Bay, that has a Starbucks. They pay for coffee, right?
Yeah.
And which is Ishtar, the goddess Ishtar.
Oh, you mean it's got the image, the goddess image, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, the Starbucks label is a pagan goddess for anybody who knows. Yeah. It's creepy to see a pagan goddess in God's house. Yeah, that would be creepy. Where was I going? Oh, jealousy. I'm glad you guys are paying more attention than I am. All right, there's two kinds of jealousy, the good kind, the bad kind. What's the good kind of jealousy?
Husband and wife, like, jealousy, right?
Like, okay.
Like,
all right. Now, is it right for a man to be jealous of his wife if she's out doing things with another man?
Yes.
He is just.
Good jealousy.
He's just for being jealous because he has a covenant relationship with that woman. And she has promised to be his wife and to forsake all others, right? So he has a right to be jealous in that situation because she belongs to him. Now, is God jealous? How many of you have read the book of Hosea? You know what it's about? God tells the prophet Hosea, I want you to go and take a prostitute to be your wife. And then I want you to have children by her and all this kind of stuff. So he does that. And then he tells them, they have children, and he tells them to name these children. One of the names was, of the child was a really long Hebrew word, but it was a sentence. It means, you are not my people. And by God doing that and telling Hosea to do that, it was a sort of an allegory of God being Hosea the prophet and the prostitute being Israel, God's people, and how that God had entered into this covenant relationship with his people, Israel, and now they're out playing the whore with false idols, God, false gods, and all that kind of stuff. And God talks about his jealousy over his wife. And he uses this as an illustration so that people can get a sense of what God is going through. That's really why he did it. He wants them to understand his own feelings. And he allows, you know, he uses that as a way to do it. And so the Apostle Paul, when he's talking about eating at the Lord's table and then going out and into all this pagan junk, he's saying that we are provoking him to jealousy. It's the same way, because we have been espoused to his son, right? Jesus Christ. To be the bride. It's a metaphor, of course. All right, so God is jealous in that sense. All right, go back to chapter, where was I? Chapter 11. let's pick up verse 26. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. How do we do that? Yeah, but how is it proclaiming the Lord's death? By what we just did here, we do it every time we come together for worship. Spencer?
When he returns, it's going to be a feast.
All right. All right, but that's then. He's saying we're doing it now. What are we doing now? Yeah, we're doing it as sort of an allegory, aren't we? We're sort of acting out in a symbolic representation, the gospel message. So if I take this bread and I stand up here and I give thanks and I break it like that, well, it's bigger. I break it. What does that symbolize? I break it. You notice every week I break the loaf in half. You know why I do that? Because the Apostle Paul talks about the blood, the bread that we break. It's right. It's exactly right. It's a symbolic representation of what was done to Christ's body because of our sin, right? We broke it. His body was broken for us, right? And then we take the cup. Well, first of all, we eat this bread. What is that representing?
Accepting Jesus.
Yeah, good, Isaac.
Jesus talked about eating my flesh.
Yeah, in John chapter, I think it's 8.
Yes.
By consuming, if this is a representation of Christ's broken body as a piece of his body that was broken for us, and I eat it, it doesn't make me a cannibal. It symbolizes, it's nourishing me. It's giving me life. He gave his life so that I could have life, so that my body could have nourishment and I could have life. All right, that's what it's symbolizing. And we do the same thing with the cup. It's symbolizing his blood that was shed. And so as we break it, symbolizing his death, and then we consume it all together, it's symbolizing that we are taking into ourselves what Christ did for us by dying on our behalf. And we're making it part of us, right? It's a symbol of that covenant relationship that we have with him. It's a very serious thing that we do here. You guys understand the gravity of this? It's very serious. So serious that look what he says next, verse 27. Whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. Whoa. I thought that was just Judas Iscariot and maybe Pilate and some of the Jews who said away with him. He says, you make light of this, and you may be guilty of that. Wow. That seems a little overkill, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem a little overkill? A little exaggeration, maybe? It shows us how serious God takes this. Isn't that right? how serious it is to him when we gather together to worship, and part of our worship is partaking of this bread and this cup. It's really, really serious to God. And if we make light of it, it's like sticking your finger in his eye. You know, if you make light of that. Yeah, Jordan?
I remember where, but he kind of compares it to trampling on Christ. I forget which book that was.
Hebrews 10. Yeah. Talks about trampling on the blood of that we were, whereby we were sanctified, and counting it as an unholy thing, and things of that nature. Yeah. Verse 28, but let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself. In other words, God isn't going to take it lying down if we make light of this, of what we're doing here, which is the central part of our worship, isn't it? The central part of our worship is partaking of the bread and the cup. It's very serious. It's a commandment that we do it, and we do it every Saturday. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. And now look at verse 30. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. Doesn't mean you took a nap in church, right? You know that. It means part of the reason why some of the people in the Corinthian church were sick and why some of them had already died was because they were taking this lightly. Wow. God takes it really seriously. See, we're not playing games here. That's the point I want you guys to understand. This is not foolishness here. We're coming into the presence of a holy God, and God is to be feared. To be loved, yes, but to be feared because of his justice and his judgment. You know, Jesus said, don't cast what is holy to the dogs or throw your pearls before swine. Why did he say that? What is it about dogs or pigs and pearls? What's that? Okay, they are filthy. But do pigs appreciate the value of pearls? No, they just trample them, and they're just mud to them. They don't care, right? Well, there's this distinction between things that are holy, things that God absolutely cares about, and things that are just common things. There's a huge distinction. One of the things that God insisted that the priests in the Old Testament do was to teach the people the difference between what was holy and what was profane, and to keep those things totally separated. Right? There was big rituals they had to go through to purify the utensils and the pots and all the kind of stuff that were in God's house that the sacrifices were given through. They had all these big elaborate rituals they had to go through to do it. Well, why? And then they had to take blood, and Moses had to sprinkle blood from this animal. He had to sprinkle blood on all the tabernacle and in all the utensils of the tabernacle on the priests, and then he had to sprinkle blood on all the people. Everybody got blood sprinkled on them. Seems silly. Why? It was a sign. What was it a sign of? That they were wholly dedicated to God for his use, and that they were not for common use. And you see this theme all throughout the Old Testament. It's in the New Testament too. It's a serious thing when we come here to worship God and we ask God to come into our presence and to listen to our requests and to offer our thanksgiving to him and then partake of this meal here. It's a very serious thing. All right, and we should take it seriously. Very seriously. It's a sign of what he did for us, the death of his son. It's a sign that we belong to him. Yes, Jordan.
Or is it we're also supposed to be very thankful too during the communion, right?
We should be thankful, yeah.
I think Eucharist literally means thanksgiving.
Yes. Right. The Latin word for communion is Eucharist. or is that the Greek word? I think it's the Greek word, actually. But the Catholics use that term even today as well. But that's what it means. It means the giving of thanks. And the term comes from the fact that Jesus, at the Last Supper, took the bread, he gave thanks and blessed it, and then he distributed it to the disciples and said, you know, this is my body and so forth. Yes. Yeah, intricate details.
And so, of course, God would be upset if we're not taking a very basic, simple ceremony. That's all we have to learn. It's just, you know, baptism and communion. There's only so much Christ told us to do as far as rituals. There's not a lot there.
Not nearly as much as the Old Testament, yeah.
Yeah, so we should get that right. It's very important just to get the basic thing that he told us to do right.
Yeah. Take it seriously. Take him seriously. Take his covenant seriously. Take the fact of what it cost him to purchase your salvation. See, the whole thing about casting your pearls before swine, it's the idea that pigs have no sense of the value of pearls. And that's why they just trample on them. They have no sense of their value, and they don't give a hoot. Right? As Christians, what God is trying to get across to us in this passage is how seriously he takes what we're doing here in our worship. And if he takes it that seriously, that he is causing some people to be sick and other Christians to die because they're not taking it seriously, maybe that's some grounds for us to take it seriously. Isn't that right? If God's taking it that seriously, we better be serious about it. Your life might depend on it. Really, I mean, if you take this passage for what it says, it's true. Yeah.
We pointed this out earlier. It's kind of like in the book of Revelation. It says anybody changes the words of this book, that he'll take his
name out of the book of life.
Book of life. Yeah. There are things that God is very serious about.
That's right. He gives us warnings, and he means it. Yeah. He means it when he gives us those kind of warnings. And we are foolish if we take it lightly. All right, I'm going to stop there. I've got a lot more. What I want to do in the next couple of lessons is I want to cover chapter 12, 13, and 14. And then we're going to be done with our worship series that we've been going through. But we're going to talk more about how the form of our worship, you know, what it should look like to be closer to what the early Christians practiced as opposed to what is modern Christianity today, where everything's just a big performance and, you know, people are spectators and all that kind of stuff. The early church was not like that at all. It was very much an interactive participation by everybody.